G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. It's been 4 months since the Australia Institute began our webinar series with Chief Economist Richard Dennis, and back then in March the topic was, what the hell is happening to the economy? And to be honest, that still seems like a pretty pertinent question. Since then, we've seen the rate of unemployment rise dramatically and massive queues form outside Centrelink. We've seen toilet paper, then hand sanitizer, then seedlings run out at the supermarket and at Bunnings. Parliament was suspended. Huge and peaceful Black Lives Matter protests happened in every capital city across Australia and in many other countries across the world, and they continue still. We've had lockdowns and outbreaks. We've closed our borders to people from overseas and people from interstate. And Australia entered into recession for the first time in 25 odd years of uninterrupted economic growth. All this after the worst bushfire season in Australia's history, fuelled by global heating and Australia's massive gas and coal exports. So there's no doubt about it, 2020 has been a roller coaster of a year, and strap in because we're only halfway through. The May budget was postponed until October, but on Thursday the 23rd of July, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg delivered a mini budget.
Australia's emergency response to the pandemic will saddle the nation with the biggest budget blowout in 70 years.
As the nation battles a health crisis which has spawned an economic meltdown.
We were warned it would be a bloodbath, that the numbers would be eye-watering. They were right, they're bad.
The Treasurer today revealing the brutal truth.
The deficit is estimated to be $85.8 billion.
The largest deficit since the Second World War, since the Second World War. Can you believe that?
Australia and the world are now experiencing the most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression.
The government's economic update has painted a very grim picture. By Christmas, one in 10 workers will be out of a job.
I think the eye-watering numbers in the half a budget update, which were released yesterday, are actually the ones around jobs. I think they're the most important ones.
To pay off this whacking great record debt, you either have to...
Lower than most other countries.
You have to... thanks, Finance Minister. You
just
have to
the point.
Increase your tax take or cut government spending. When can the economy... When can the economy afford to do either?
We're the party of lower taxes, and we've proven that. I mean, our pathway to growing the economy is through lower taxes, not higher taxes.
What the economic update doesn't offer is a plan for recovery. That's still 3 months away when we should get a budget.
But I think the reality of where people have views on the Coalition versus Labor on economic management mean that they'll get away with it, whether it's right or not.
So today we're talking to the Australia Institute's Chief Economist Richard Dennis and Senior Economist Matt Grudnoff about what you need to know from yesterday's mini budget. And this was recorded live on Friday, the 24th of July, 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
G'day, everyone. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining me today.
G'day.
G'day. Matt, I'll come to you first. A lot of numbers always come out of a budget, but what are the key figures that came out of yesterday's mini budget?
Well, I mean, the mini budget was basically, it didn't have any new policy in it, but it was basically what Treasury thinks, what the hell is going on in the economy? Well, this is what they think. And I suppose what's interesting is normally a budget has 4 years of that they project forward for 4 years. This time they only really projected forward to 2 years. And one of the years that was projected forward was actually last year. So we've really only got one extra year. And I think that's mainly because Treasury doesn't really know what's going to happen. They've made a lot of assumptions about the future, but, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen over the next 6 months or 12 months with any real certainty. So it's interesting to see that Treasury is also completely flummoxed and willing to admit that they're completely, or not completely in the dark, but largely in the dark. But I suppose some of the big numbers, you know, we're going to have some very large deficits. We sort of already knew that, there'll be people that make a lot of fuss about large deficits. And it was interesting, actually, to hear Matthias Cormann defend the large deficit. If you just from the press conference. I've got this great quote from him. He said, "You asked about the level of debt that we are at today. I ask you, what is the alternative?"
I ask you, what is the alternative? I mean, are you suggesting that we shouldn't have provided the support we did to boost our health system, to protect jobs, to protect livelihoods? I mean, in the circumstances, what was the alternative?
And he's absolutely right. And the Australia Institute and many others were telling him that 10 years ago when he was bagging out the Labor government for having a similar sort of program of running it into deficit in order to stabilise the economy. But I think that kind of sums up where the government's at. They've spent a lot of money and they've supported the economy. And now we sort of, this mini budget tells us how well, it's almost like a report card of how well they've done. So it tells us where they think unemployment's going to be. It's going to keep rising all the way up till Christmas, where it'll be over 9%. It tells us about what's going to happen to wages and inflation. Basically, wages is going to grow at about 1.25% and inflation's going to grow at 1.25% this year. So basically, real wages are going to be zero. It's basically describing an economy that is extremely flat, that is going nowhere and probably needs more support going forward.
Thanks, Matt. So overall, Richard, what's your takeaway from yesterday?
Well, I mean, what we heard yesterday is how bad it's been, how bad it's going to get. But what we haven't heard yet from the government at all is what it's going to do about it. As Matt said, Matthias Cormann and Josh Frydenberg both yesterday, were at times the sort of ultimate Keynesians, saying, "Look, we spent an enormous amount of money, and that propped up the economy in exactly the way that Matt and I and most other economists were saying 4 months ago was necessary." So they're quite clear. Look, we spent money; it worked. You know, unemployment would be so much higher if we hadn't done that. Yet, earlier this week, the same two people announced that they're going to cut the job seeker supplement and cut the job keeper allowance. And both of those decisions, both of those cuts in government spending mean things are going to get worse in the last quarter of this year, not better. So we've had an amazing kind of week. So you can't quite call it a backflip. It's just a confusion. You know, the week starts with, we have to cut spending. We've got no choice but to cut spending. And then we have the defence of the biggest deficit in modern history, which is, thank God we spend all that money. Aren't we good for spending all that money? Well, yeah, I agree with them about that. But if that's the case, why did they cut JobSeeker? Why did they cut JobKeeper? And more importantly, what is the plan? What is the plan to actually create jobs for the 1.6 million people that we expect to be on unemployment benefits? What is the plan to create those jobs? Because yesterday's mini budget was a statement of, here's where the economy's going. We're now being told we have to wait 2 more months to hear what the government's plan is. Well, that's 6 months since this crisis start, and we still don't have a plan to actually generate jobs for 1.6 million people. Now, whether it's a Green New Deal, whether it's a Brown New Deal, whatever, whether it's an old deal, what is the deal? Because at the moment, the government's still kind of stuck where they started, which was, this is going to be temporary, we're going to snap back, and everything's going to be all right. So, you know, their terror at the beginning of this was making long-term commitments. Well, guess what? We're in the middle of a long-term economic crisis, and we're now being told to wait another 2 months to hear what the plan is to actually create some jobs.
And Richard, you wrote an article for The Guardian earlier this week pointing out that a cut in government spending is contractionary economic policy. For those of us who aren't economists, what does that mean?
Well, so GDP, gross domestic product, national income, GDP is the sum of its parts, all right? You calculate GDP by calculating a bunch of parts. What are the parts? The parts are consumer spending, private investment, government spending, and net exports. So when you add those four things together, you literally get GDP. That's what GDP is. It's the sum of those four things. Well, we know that consumer spending is going to fall because, firstly, we've got an enormous unemployment problem, and second, we've shut the borders to immigration. So there's going to be less consumers than we thought, and they're going to have lower incomes than we thought, and they're going to be spending less than we thought. So consumer spending's down. Net exports are down because we have no tourism industry anymore, and we have no education industry anymore, and all of our trading partners are in a recession too. So net exports, overseas customers aren't buying, domestic customers aren't buying. So the private sector's not investing, funnily enough. Why would you build a new factory when your domestic customers and international customers aren't buying? So the only thing, literally, so remember, GDP is consumer spending plus investment plus net exports plus government spending. The only thing propping up GDP at the moment is this big boost in government spending. Yet on Tuesday this week, the government promised to cut government spending. They promised to cut government spending. What they just promised to do was cut GDP. What they just promised to do was make more unemployment. And that's the contradiction that I was talking about this week, because they promised to cut government spending. They promised to do that on Tuesday. And then they show up on Thursday and say, look how good all that spending was at saving jobs. Well, which is it?
Yeah.
And even in their budget numbers, that they're predicting 240,000 new unemployed people by the end of the year. They're predicting that unemployment will go up. So at a time when they think unemployment is rising, they're withdrawing stimulus. That's just silly.
So we've got about 600 people who are joining us today. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming along. I've got greetings from Noongar country, from Adelaide, from the Southern Highlands, which is Gundagara land. Welcome to everyone from all across Australia. Thanks for joining us today. Matt, to go to you now, earlier this week, the Australia Institute had released some modelling about the impacts of the cut to the JobSeeker coronavirus supplement. Can you take us through that and what that means for people who find themselves without a job at the moment?
Yeah, look, so when the pandemic first began, the government effectively doubled the dole, and they doubled it by introducing this thing called the coronavirus supplement, and it was $550 a fortnight. And what it effectively did was it lifted over 400,000 Australians out of poverty. In one single policy change, it lifted over 400,000 Australians out of poverty, because we know that if you're on unemployment benefits, then you live in poverty. That they have been chronically and horribly low for so long that you just simply can't live on them. So that one policy change lifted an enormous number of people out of poverty. But what the government announced on Tuesday was that they were going to cut that coronavirus supplement. They weren't going to get rid of it completely, but they're going to cut it from $550 a fortnight down to $250 a fortnight. So they're going to cut $300 a fortnight out of unemployment benefits. Now, people on unemployment benefits, obviously very low income, $300 a fortnight is an enormous amount. And what that will do is that will throw 370,000 Australians back into poverty, including 80,000 children. And that's what our modelling shows.
80,000 children in poverty, that's a very grim statistic. And I know when everyone from the Business Council of Australia through to welfare bodies like ACOS were calling to raise the rate, it is because it was so low, and it was, for example, forcing people to skip meals, to be unable to afford medicine and that kind of thing. So, yeah, not only will it have a poor impact on the budget, but that's a very real impact for that many tens of thousands of children.
And we know that when children are in poverty, when they're, you know, quite young, that can have lifelong impact. So even if they then later come out of poverty, they'll be stuck with the effects of that. It can lead to them falling behind in school. It can damage their emotional development. It can damage their health for the rest of their lives. So it's horrible that having done such good to lift so many people out of poverty, they're turning around now when we're still in a recession, when people are still losing their jobs. Through no fault, then they decided that they wanted a job in tourism or they wanted a job in a cafe. They've been thrown into unemployment, and the government is now going to throw them back into poverty.
Yeah, and Ebony, sorry, just to take that point further, Eb. I mean, the government, you know, everything they've said this week is really quite confusing and contradictory. The argument for why we have to be so brutally cruel to the poorest people in Australia who are suffering unemployment because of a pandemic, the economic argument for doing that is that we have to give people an incentive to go and look for work. And this is kind of classic conservative political strategy. You have to be cruel to be kind. You know, it's not that I want to make people live in grinding poverty. It's but by cutting the incomes of the poorest people in the country, I'm actually helping them. I'm giving them an incentive to go and look for work. Well, let's unpack that. The most recent labour force statistics from the ABS said that in June, when we had this new supplement in place, employment increased by 200,000 people. 200,000 people found jobs in June.
That was the largest monthly increase ever.
The largest ever surge in employment in Australian history happened with this full supplement in place. So let's be crystal clear. The supplement did not stop the largest ever monthly surge in employment in Australian history. And if we had another couple of months of 200,000 job creation, that'd be wonderful. And again, let's be clear, the current level of unemployment benefits and the current supplement in no way impeded that surge. Yet we have to be cruel to be kind. We're kidding. Well, the Conservatives are telling us that if we don't cut unemployment benefits, people won't go and look for a job. Well, we just saw last month that despite the big increase in unemployment benefits, 220,000 people went and looked and found a job. The other kind of limb to this cruel logic is that if we don't not only cut unemployment benefits but keep wages down and introduce all these new labour market flexibilities, if we don't have all this massive IR reform in the middle of the worst pandemic that we've ever had, if we don't do that, then again, somehow there's some sort of speed limit on the rate of our economic recovery. Well, anytime you hear anyone making this argument, just ask them, well, how come it didn't slow us down in June? The IR system didn't slow us down in June. The welfare system didn't slow us down in June. Nothing about Australia's structure slowed the economy's ability to create 200,000 jobs last month. The reason that we don't expect another 200,000 jobs to be created next month is a shortage of demand. That's why the government should be spending more money, right? But everyone needs to understand this. Nothing in our economic structure stopped the largest growth in employment in history. Not our welfare system, not our IR system, nothing. There is no structural impediment to employment growing 200,000 in a month. What there is a shortage of demand. And until we address that, unemployment is going to stay at miserably high levels.
Thanks, Richard. I've just been told, sent a text message that modelling on JobSeeker that Matt was talking about is trending on Twitter. So if you happen to be on Twitter, I think the figure 370,000 is trending. And that's the number of Australians that will be pushed into poverty according to our job seeker modelling that we released earlier this week. I just want to stay on unemployment for a little while because I know from talking to you two over many years now that during a recession, unemployment is the main way that people experience a recession. It's also the biggest concern for most people, either hanging on to their job or the prospect of losing it, or indeed they've already lost it and are just trying to look for work in this wicked situation where I think earlier in the week it was something like 13 people looking for work for every job vacancy. Richard, you talked earlier about the fact that there really isn't or wasn't any plan unveiled yesterday to get the unemployment rate down. What types of things would you have been hoping to see in yesterday's budget?
Well, the first thing I would have hoped to see was a complete revocation of the announcements on Tuesday, which was to slash the incomes of the poorest people in Australia. Because not only is the unemployment benefit a way to literally boost the living standards of millions of Australians, it's one of the easiest and most effective ways to pour money into the economy in a way that will create jobs. So we published a paper at the very beginning of the pandemic saying that stimulus spending needs to be targeted in order to maximise the job creation per dollar, to minimise the leakages, and to target the spending at the regions that need it most. Well, guess what? When you pay unemployed people money, you are literally putting money into the community with the unemployed person in it. So when you've got a region with lots of unemployed people, the easiest way to target money to boost demand in that region is to boost the payment that you give to the unemployed. So yeah, look, the first thing I wish they had done yesterday was roll back the ridiculous decision they announced on Tuesday to punish the unemployed in the hope that if we whip them hard enough, they'll go create a job. Doesn't work like that. But going forward, we hear a lot about infrastructure. We hear a lot about construction. And fine, we should absolutely go and build some things. It's a good time to build some things. But construction has very low labour intensity. Per $1 million you spend on construction, you create 1.5 jobs. You spend $1 million on education, you create 10 jobs. So what we need, and we can't wait 2 more months, what we need from the government is a plan to not just pump money into the economy, but to pump jobs into the economy. You can spend a lot of money and not create a lot of jobs when, no, it's easy. Just spend the money on things that aren't very labour intensive. Now, the most labour intensive industries in Australia are health and education and services like aged care. So if only the community supported better health, better education and better aged care, if only there were shortages in our health system, our education system and our aged care system, if only we had gaping holes, according to multiple royal commissions, in the way that we help the elderly and help the disabled. So it's really, really, really simple. The government has to prop up aggregate demand by spending more money. And if it spends that money on labour-intensive activities in the local regions with the highest unemployment, on services that deliver lasting benefits, not only will we have lower unemployment by Christmas, we'll have a better society and a better economy in 5 years' time because of it.
Thanks, Richard. Matt, I want to stick with jobs for a little while. We have looked in the past at the gender impacts of this recession that seems to be impacting women a little bit more than men. But what are some of those other trends in who's unemployed and who's losing their jobs and the impact of insecure work on those stats?
Yeah, look, I mean, the industries that have been most badly impacted are things like tourism and accommodation, food, services, those kinds of things. But whenever a recession comes along, the people that get impacted the quickest and the fastest are the people in insecure work. So the casuals, people who are contractors, people who are basically are in insecure work. It's very easy to get rid of them very quickly, and that's what firms tend to do. And what we found in some research we've done at the Australia Institute is that even in industries where they're mostly men in that particular industry, women are being disproportionately impacted. That is, so the industries that have lost the most, like tourism and food services, tend to have a lot of women in them. But even when we look at industries that have more men employed than women, still women are being let go faster than men. So this is certainly a recession that's impacting women more than men. Women are losing, as a proportion of the labour market, are losing jobs faster than men are.
We've also ditched the free childcare, probably one of the single best policies the Morrison government's ever implemented. And so far, none of what we've seen in the stimulus is really targeting. I mean, they're still very general, JobKeeper and these things. There's been very few targeted stimulus aimed at increasing women's employment or, you know, specific geographical areas or anything like that.
Well quite the opposite. When it comes to childcare, the government has targeted childcare by taking away JobKeeper from that particular industry. So it's been very specific in withdrawing help for an industry that's dominated by female workers. And also, I mean, childcare is a really silly industry to cut. You know, as the government or the Prime Minister was at pains to point out when he was trying to convince the states to open the schools back up, if you've got kids at home, it makes it very hard to do work. You're less likely to participate in the labour market. You're less likely to be able to work. Well, exactly the same is true if you have preschool aged children. If we were to supply free childcare, we would be able to boost participation in this economy in the long term. So not only would it be good in the short term, if you give free childcare out, then people who are currently paying for it have more money to buy other things and spend more money in the economy. But in the long term, when the recession eases away, our economy will actually grow faster and larger because more people, particularly women who tend to take up the bulk of the caring responsibility, will be able to go back to work and produce more things in Australia.
Yeah, and it's worse than that, Eb, because don't forget at the beginning of this crisis, the government made an arbitrary decision to exempt a lot of casuals from JobKeeper. And we know that women are disproportionately represented in the casual workforce. And the government also arbitrarily decided to exclude the universities, which, again, are big employers of women. So to the extent that there's been any targeting, to the extent that there's been any industry policy, it's all revolved around construction and infrastructure, very, very male intensive, but worse than that, not very job intensive. I mean, when I said before, you spend $1 million on education, you create 10 jobs, you create $1 million on construction, you create 1.5. When you spend $1 million on a female-dominated industry like education or health, you still create more jobs for men because like you create around 3 jobs for men and 7 jobs for women when you spend $1 million on health, for example. So it's not like we have to pick between do we want to help men or do we want to help women. If we spend money on labour-intensive services like health, like education, we create more jobs for women and more jobs for men. But when we focus on spending so much money on infrastructure and construction, we don't create many jobs at all, and the overwhelming majority of the tiny amount of jobs go to blokes.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the international picture before we start taking questions from the audience. I noticed that European governments, the EU, approved a really ambitious climate change plan, I think this week, spending about 500 billion euros as part of a green stimulus. So that'll be spent on everything from electric vehicles to renewable energy and agriculture reforms. Richard, how does Australia compare to this? I mean, I think we can all guess, but what does the picture look like?
Well, we're streets ahead of them, Eb. I mean, we're still doing our feasibility study into a new coal-fired power station in Western Queensland, and of course, we believe that electric vehicles are going to ruin the weekend. Look, there's nothing in our constitution that says we have to be smart. There's nothing in our constitution that says we have to be forward-looking. Our duly elected government is free to make as ridiculous a decision as it wants. The obligation on us as citizens is to call that out and to put better ideas forward. Again, the criteria that we've talked about throughout this crisis, labour-intensive, local job creation and lasting benefits, the installation of renewable energy, the rollout of electric vehicle charging stations, indeed the rollout of electric vehicles, whether they're buses or ferries, you know, there's enormous capacity right now in Australia to install new forms of energy generation, new forms of energy distribution, and new forms of transport infrastructure that will create jobs that are spread out across the economy, which will be delivering benefits in 20 and 30 years' time when young people are telling us to shut up and stop talking about the pandemic. So, yeah, the Europeans don't know how to think long term, obviously. You know, here in Australia, we've got it nailed. They're spending $500 billion setting up for the energy system of tomorrow. We're still doing cost-benefit analyses on new coal-fired power stations. One of us has read the room on differently than the others about where technology is going to end up. Sadly, I think I'm well and truly on the side of the European interpretation.
We might go to the Q&A from the audience now. We've got about 650 people on the line at the moment. Thanks for joining us today and thanks for some of these excellent questions. The first one is going to be from Brad Sherman, who asks, what do you expect to be the fallout of the drastic reduction in net migration? Seems to me that Australia has used net migration as an easy way to produce growth in GDP. Has it provided growth in GDP per capita?
I don't know who wants to take that one. Yeah, look, so it's really interesting. We talk all the time about GDP and how growing GDP is the be-all and end-all. Well, the economists that invented GDP were at pains to say, please don't use it as an indicator of progress, but we completely ignore them. And population growth really challenges, you know, what we mean by the benefits of GDP. So let me give you an example. China's GDP is far bigger than Australia's, far bigger. But their GDP per person is much lower than ours. Monaco has got a far smaller GDP than Australia, but a much higher GDP per person. So when we talk about GDP as if the having a big economy means we're better off, it doesn't actually mean anything. What we always should be talking about, if we're going to talk about GDP at all, is GDP per person. Now, in Australia, for the last 20 years, we've had some of the highest rates of immigration of any developed country. Most years, it's been the highest rate of population growth for any developed country. And when you've got population growth of around 1 million people every 4 years, so picture a map of Australia. Every 2 years, we plonk a new dot on the map about the size of Canberra. Every 2 years, we just plonk a new city down the size of Canberra, except, of course, we don't do that. We spread it out on the fringes of all of our existing cities. Of course, when you've got 1 million people moving here every 4 years, GDP goes up. Like, it would be inconceivable that it doesn't. But does rapid population growth have an impact on GDP per person? Well, no. According to the pinko lefties at the Productivity Commission, who were the last ones to have a close look at this, to the extent that there's any link between population growth and GDP per capita, it's trivial. And that's not really surprising because, again, are there big populous countries that are poor? Yes. Are there small countries with small populations that are rich? Yes. So guess what? Population isn't the determinant of whether people are rich or poor. But what we have done in Australia is we've poured an extra Canberra worth of population in every 2 years, but we've massively underspent on the social and economic infrastructure. And it really irritates me, and I hope people hear what I'm saying. There's a huge opportunity here. Every year, every state treasurer, every state and federal minister announces record spending on health and record spending on education for the simple reason that every year is a record year for population. What we need to do every year is look at health spending per person, education spending per person. It doesn't matter that we're spending billions more on education than we used to. We're educating far more people than we used to. So I don't think population growth is evil or great. I don't think it's good or bad. It's just a thing. The absence of population growth is going to mean that Coles, Woolworths, the Commonwealth Bank and Foxtel won't just get lazy 2% growth in their customer numbers every year, so they're going to hate it. Anyone that sells stuff loves new customers moving in all the time. It's going to put downward pressure on house prices, but You know, we said we were trying to fix housing affordability. For decades, I've been told population growth doesn't cause higher house prices. How ridiculous. Of course it did. But now that we don't have rapid population growth, people are saying, oh, obviously house prices are going to get cheaper. Well, if we wanted cheaper house prices, that's not a big problem. So, it will have economic effects. It's not devastating. But if your whole business model is that every year 2% more customers get captured by your local monopoly, you'll scream blue murder about low population growth.
I was going to see if I can come to Pia Brouse or Pia Bruce next. Did you have a question for the panel?
Yes, thank you very much. I'll just find the wording of it. Thank you very much for your information. It's really, really interesting. What I was interested to hear from you is whether you predict that the federal government is going to spend enormous amounts of money on the fossil fuel industries and their associated businesses as their version of a way to get us out of this depression.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I reckon that's exactly Definitely. What they're going to do. First question yesterday when Josh Frydenberg and Matthias Cormann gave their press conference, the first question, as luck would have it, was from an eager journalist who was just right up the front, ready to say, boy, hasn't the mining industry saved us yet again? How good is the mining industry, Matthias Cormann? Mining industry, no one's suggesting we shut it down tomorrow, but it employs almost no one. The coal industry employs 45,000 people out of a population of 25 million. You could double Australia's coal production, and you'd create 45,000 jobs at best, assuming the new coal mines weren't automated, which, by the way, the companies want them to be. So mining, because we give our coal and our iron ore and our resources, because we give it to the mining companies for either free or at such ridiculously low prices that when they sell it overseas, they make enormous profits. Because they make enormous profits selling our coal and our iron ore, it's absolutely true that they pay a lot of company tax to us. But let's be clear, the profit they're making is selling our raw materials. And countries like Saudi Arabia and countries like Norway have got quite a different approach. They don't obviously understand. The Saudis don't know how to tax oil, and the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund's going nowhere. We in Australia obviously know how to get good value out of resources. But, you could double the size of the resources industry tomorrow, and it wouldn't fix Australia's unemployment problems.
Look, I mean, the government set up a commission to look into how to get us out of the recession, and they basically just it's headed up by an ex-gas bloke, and it's full of fossil fuel sort of things. And what did they come back with? They came back with a gas-led recovery. So, absolutely, fossil fuels is going to be front and centre in the government's idea about how we build back.
How we build back browner.
That's right.
The Australia Institute also released some research this week showing that gas creates the fewest job per dollar invested of virtually any industry, fewer even, Richard, than the coal mining industry.
What's your point, Ed?
So not very good bang for our buck there. And hopefully that commission can come up with something slightly better than a gas-fired recovery, but not much hope on that front. The next question is here from Jerry Corvisanos, who asks, why did Labor shadow treasurer state publicly that the coalition government failed in economic management as evidenced by budget deficits prior to COVID? That's a bit of a long-winded one. I think it's asking about the deficit and the deficit myth. So perhaps we might take the conversation in that direction. Matt, how much do we have to worry about debt and deficit at the moment?
Well, not at all. But if you don't believe me, then the governor of the Reserve Bank, and let's be clear, Reserve bankers make economists look interesting. These are extremely boring, extremely conservative individuals. And the governor of the Reserve Bank has told the government on multiple occasions that they should not worry about the debt at all. That stimulating the economy, avoiding unemployment, is far, far, far more important than the debt is. And that they should just put the debt completely out of their heads and just focus on making sure that unemployment doesn't continue to rise. And in fact, more than that, to make sure that unemployment comes back down, that will cause more economic damage than the debt. The other thing that both Matthias Cormann and Josh Frydenberg said in their press conference was that Australia, when we look around the world, is a low-debt country. And after we do all of this spending, we'll still be a low-debt country. It's good to hear them do that. I remember the Australia Institute put an infographic that did quite well about 8 years ago saying exactly that, and the government criticised it. Well, not the government, sorry, the coalition who were then the opposition criticised it. So it's good that they've come and they've joined reality and they're back on the side of facts. But it would have been nice if they'd been there sooner. But yes, the debt is not an issue. It's not going to be an issue if we continue to spend. And it's not just people like the Australia Institute that are saying that. It's Reserve Bank Governor, who is the guy who manages the government's debt, who is also saying that.
I agree with everything Matt just said. It's amazing to watch the government contort itself over these things. A lot of people have been told to sort of think about debt from their own point of view. And, you know, they were told that, you know, you and I can't just rack up enormous debts and therefore government should. But, there's so many problems with that. But let me break down a few. No one believes that. Individuals go into debt all the time. Governments love debt so much that they make kids incur it. In fact, we profit. We supply debt to help kids go to uni. It's called HECS. All right, so the idea that individuals are irresponsible if they incur debt is contradicted by the fact that the government actually procures debt to young people because it knows that spending now delivers benefits in the short term. Anyone that's ever bought a house might have understood that they ran a bit of a deficit that year, spent more than they earned, and accumulated a large debt that year. But when in Australia we talk about net debt, we're not actually netting it off against the assets we own. We're just actually talking about the debt. So when you go buy a house for $500,000 and you've got a debt of $500,000 and a house worth $500,000, you're no worse off, you're no better off. But no human, no individual just looks at the debt side of the ledger and ignores the asset side of the ledger. And then there's how long does the debt last? Most people want to pay off their debt before they retire because they think, oh, my income's going to fall, so wouldn't it be nice to have all my debts paid off before then? Okay, well, if you want to pay off your debt before you retire, great. When do you think Australia's going to retire? What year are we going to pull up stumps? So that's it. We're tapping out now. So unless you think Australia's going to retire sometime soon as a nation state, there's absolutely no reason for us to pay off our debts before some arbitrary time. Now, all that's true. And, of course, the reason a nation state is nothing like you and I is that nation states can literally print the currency that they repay their debts in. And that's, you know, a lot of interest in modern monetary theory about that. But you don't even have to get to modern monetary theory to see how ridiculous it is to worry about a particular level of debt. And then just finally, like to hear Matthias Cormann yesterday saying, don't worry about the level of debt trebling. Don't worry about that. It's lower than the OECD average. Okay, fine. But where do I find in the economics textbook that it's relative debt to some arbitrary group of countries that matter? For decades, I've been told that debt was bad and that the lower it was, the better it was. Now, magically, debt's fine as long as you can find a country that's got more than you. Well, don't we tell our kids to not use the excuse? Don't we say, you know, would you stick your head in an oven if your friends stuck their head in an oven? Like, why? So we heard yesterday that our AAA credit rating is going to be fine. Great. Just shows what a bullshit indicator a AAA credit rating is. Because we're about to treble the debt. And we've been told for decades that if we don't cut our debt, we'll lose our AAA credit rating. Now it's okay to treble our debt, which, by the way, I agree with, and we'll keep our AAA credit rating because Germany, because Belgium. Yeah. Like, who knew? Right? So everything we've been told about debt, everything we've been told about debt for decades isn't found in any economics textbook. It isn't consistent with the way we actually deal with debt. And now it's just, you know, it's just all la-la land stuff listening to the contorted stories they're making up. So don't worry about the debt. Don't worry about the debt. Worry a lot about what we're spending it on. Mm. You can waste money. You can give it to people who don't need it. Don't worry about the level. Think about the shape of the debt and what it is we're buying with it. That's what matters.
And this is just everyone's regular reminder whenever I hear anyone talk about credit ratings agencies, that all of them rated AAA the subprime mortgages that caused the global financial crisis. So I'm I'm still not sure why any of them have a job.
Anybody listens to them.
Exactly. Why do we listen to them?
These random interventions of yours, Em, I don't see the point you're making.
My next two questions are kind of, I think, speak to a similar point. I've got one from Brad Sherman and one from Harry Otley. And they ask, how do you increase increasing demand when COVID is causing restrictions, preventing people from going out and spending in some places in the economy? What areas of the economy can safely use the stimulus? Is this time to build bike paths, roads, renew public playing fields? And Harry asked about social housing and that type of spending. Matt, I might come to you first on that one.
Yeah, look, that's a really, really good question. And this recession is different to all the other ones we've had before. When a recession usually starts, the government is encouraging people to go out and spend, go out to restaurants, go out to movies, go out to the pub. The exact opposite is the case. So the question is exactly right. Like, we can't just throw stimulus spending in the way we normally would to try and encourage people. We've got to be a bit smarter about it. And there's two things here. The first thing is the government needs to, and initially they did this, is to help those that we can't stimulate at this point. So the JobKeeper, JobSeeker, coronavirus supplement, for example, are ways of protecting people in the recession that are going to struggle because simply their jobs in tourism, working in restaurants, have gone and, you know, no matter how much stimulus we throw in, unless we want the coronavirus to go nuts through the population, it's not going to come back. The second part is we need to think smart about what sort of stimulus we put in place. And in this particular case, I think it's often better to devolve down to the state and the local level. I think that there are plenty of local councils around Australia who are able to upgrade their facilities to build new facilities in a way that, firstly, is COVID safe. So, you know, bike paths, as they said, but also is the sort of things that are going to be used into the future. Because when the pandemic first started, Richard and I and another colleague, Dave, wrote a paper. And we looked at what we called secondary benefits, which were basically benefits that were going to last long after the stimulus spending was gone. And we need to focus on how to get best bang for our buck for those secondary benefits. What's going are we going to continue to use decades from now, long after we've forgotten about the pandemic and the recession, but we're still going to get the benefits of these things?
Yeah, look, again, that paper Matt was talking about, I think it was the fiscal principles for a pandemic or something. But, look, Matt had a great idea in that paper. One of them was, look, at the moment, there's no tourism going on the Great Barrier Reef, but Crown of Thorns starfish are still busy out there munching into what's left of the coral since climate change. We should be paying tour boat operators and dive instructors to go and do the labour-intensive task of killing as many crown of thorns starfish as they can. We create jobs. It's labour-intensive. It's in the local region suffering the most. It delivers lasting benefits. So the question is right, but we've got to get past just building stuff. Mm. You bet. Yep, give me a bike path. Fine, no problem. Social housing, tick, great. I'm not anti-building. It's just not nearly enough. We have to think as much about what things do we need to do as much as what things do we need to build. I mean, there's a trove of incredibly valuable historic documents known as every newspaper written in the last 100 years that need to be digitized. This work is labor intensive. It's skilled, but people can acquire those skills and they can do a lot of that work from home. There is enormous amounts of valuable work that needs to be done if we get a little bit creative. And again, of course, we need to talk about the macroeconomics of, is the government spending enough? But unfortunately, you know, generations of economists have been trained to think that economics has nothing to do with creativity. Economics has nothing to do with ideas. It's just about lecturing people to cut spending. Well, that's all crap. We're going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. We need to think creatively about what are the things that create a lot of jobs in the short term and a lot of lasting benefits. And it's not all about concrete. And, you know, there are tasks that need doing that will deliver benefits for decades or centuries to come. Imagine if in 200 years' time, it's impossible to go and read newspapers from the 1800s or World War I. Well, we can go fix that. We can go fix that right now. We can digitize an incredible trove of irreplaceable historic documents. But instead, we're going to spend $500 million making the war memorial bigger. Well, no one's going to forget we had the wars, but imagine if we forgot how people felt about them, you know, while they were being fought.
I've got a question here from Lee Shears, who asks, where does Australian manufacturing fit into jobs for the future? Lee, we're actually having a webinar next Tuesday with Jim Standard from the Centre for Future Work and the AMWU National Secretary, Paul Bastian, to talk about that exact topic. I'll give details of that at the end, but I suggest you tune in for that, and I'm going to skip that question for now. David Cassells asks, given the projected fall in GST revenues to the states and territories, should the federal government be making compensatory payments to the states to maintain essential services and, importantly, public sector employment? Just one second before I throw to you, I'm also going to come to you next. Janine Kistinen, we'll come to you after this for your question. But first to you, Matt, on public service jobs.
Absolutely. The government should be encouraging not only them to employ more people and stimulate the economy, but they need to be encouraging other levels of government, including state government, to spend more and stimulate the economy. And as I said, state governments and local governments have some great projects out there that they're able to identify that need paying. That these are the projects that usually when you come forward with them, they say we can't afford them. Well, as Richard said, we're going to spend $200 billion at least, and we probably need to spend more. Now the affordability problem is gone. Now is the time to bring forward those projects that everybody said we couldn't afford them, but they had great benefits. We'll assess them. We'll find out which ones do have the biggest benefits, which one employ the most people, and then we'll start doing them in order to employ people, in order to stop unemployment from rising. So absolutely, state governments are a great place for the government to be pushing money into in order for them to spend more, in order for more employment to occur.
Richard, did you want to respond to that question from earlier?
Yeah, look, it's really important to think about the role of the state governments here. State governments, like the federal government, should be borrowing a lot of money and spending a lot of money. And again, you know, there's a lot of people interested in modern monetary theory, some of them on the chat here, and they often say, look, you know, governments are different. They can print their own currencies. Well, state governments can't. State governments can't print their own currency. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't be borrowing to spend. Like, both are true. You know, and yeah. I think we need to be careful not to get trapped into having a theoretical fight here. It's straightforward, old-fashioned Keynesian economics to say when aggregate demand, when private sector demand falls, public sector should boost its demand. That's true for the Commonwealth, brackets, who can print their own currency, close brackets, and state governments who can't. They both should be doing it. There's a real problem in Australia at the moment. You see governments like the New South Wales government saying, oh, we've got to cut our spending because we don't want to run a deficit. Well, that's, you've got the federal government trying to put its foot on the floor, and you've got the state government putting its foot on the brake. We need state governments to accept exactly the same old-fashioned Keynesian argument that it's actually responsible for them to borrow now, to bring forward activity now, to employ more people now, to boost public sector wages right now. All of that makes sense, whether they can print their own currency or not.
Sticking with public sector wages there, I also, just harking back to insecure work in places being the cause of workplace transmission and outbreaks where people without paid sick leave or access to leave at all, really feel forced to keep going to work in order to keep food on the table and a roof over their head. How important are decent jobs like you find in the public service with decent wages, but importantly, good conditions going to be as part of the way that we fight this virus in the long term until we have a vaccine?
Well, yeah. We've seen around the world what happens where good systems of preventative health and public health and sick pay don't exist. And the Asian countries and the European countries that had the big early breakouts, the early breakouts were typically amongst the part of the workforce that had the worst conditions and the worst housing conditions and the worst workplace conditions. So, yeah, we don't want people who are sick feeling like they have to choose between infecting other people or being poor. So, yeah, I think we're really kind of exposing now a lot of the problems with the gig economy. And that is that, when the economy was growing steadily, a lot of young people entered a labour market where they were told, you're young, you don't need sickness benefits. Well, actually, everyone does. They're not just good for the individual, they're good for the community. And I said at the beginning, the government's starting to say, we need to get rid of industrial relations protections for people. I think probably the opposite is true. We probably need more industrial relations protections, not less.
Now, we've only got a few minutes left, so I'm actually going to cut us off there. I'm going to ask you for a one-minute response to this question each. One of the things that's been floated is bringing forward the massive income tax cuts that the government had previously legislated. Good or bad idea? I'll start with you, Richard.
Look, what we need to do is spend money in the way that creates the most dollars, the most jobs where they're needed the most. There is no evidence to support the idea that giving someone with a full-time job like myself a pay cut is going to create more jobs than spending that same amount of money increasing the New Start supplement, the Job Seeker supplement or something else. There is no evidence to say of all the things we could do right now, an income tax cut would be anywhere near close to the top of the list. Free childcare would be far, far, far more effective.
And Matt?
Look, it's a terrible idea. We've done modelling that shows that the tax cuts, particularly the stage 2 and 3 that they're trying to bring forward, overwhelmingly go to high income earners. High income earners save a big chunk of their money. It's bad stimulus. It's bad for inequality. We know that societies with more inequality grow slower. And as Richard said, it takes away money from the state being able to do things like childcare. If the government wants to use money for stimulus, tax cuts to high income earners are the worst. There are heaps better ways they can do it.
And if I recall correctly, they also benefit men much more than women. Is that right, Matt?
Yep, 2 to 1. So every $2 of this tax cut that goes to men, women will get 1.
Well, stuff that.
What's your point again, Eb? What's your point?
We are going to have to wrap it up there. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everyone's questions, but thank you. They were really thoughtful and we covered a wide range of topics today. So thanks so much for participating, everyone.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned. You can check out our website for all the details of our upcoming webinars at tai.org.au/webinars to register. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. And visit our website for all our latest research and content. You can find us on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Matt Grudnoff is at Matt Grudnoff, that's GRUDNOFF. And Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And remember, stay 1.5 metres away, keep washing those hands, and thanks for listening.